During the fall and winter of 2018-2019, WTIP has reported on a variety of topics related to climate change and its impact on fish and fishing here in the North Shore area. Tonight, we're here to discuss what climate change means from a variety of perspectives, including what is meant by climate change, and when and if these changes will impact anglers and fish along the North Shore and other parts of northeastern Minnesota. Good evening, I'm Joe Fredericks, and once again, climate change and its impact on North Shore fisheries is this month's third Thursday community conversation. Well, with us in the studio to discuss climate change and what this means in Minnesota and specific to the North Shore are Finland Area Fisheries Supervisor with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Dean Perrone. We also have Grand Marais Area Fisheries Supervisor for the DNR, Steve Persons. And joining us on the phone from the airport down in the Twin Cities is Tom Beery from Minnesota Sea Grant. We're glad that all of you are able to join this conversation tonight. So let's jump right into it here. There's often one of two reactions when it comes to climate change. One of those reactions might be that it's real and we need to do something, or the other reaction might be that it's a hoax and it's impacting the way that government does business. So, Tom, once again, I mentioned that you're down at the airport in the Twin Cities, and if there's any issues with audio, that's the situation, that Tom could join us from the airport, and we really appreciate that he's able to do that. So, Tom, once again, one of these two reactions is kind of what seems to happen. Either it's real climate change and society, the human race needs to do something about it, or it's a hoax, and it's impacting the way that government does business. So, Tom, what are your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, so, you know, we see, number one, you know, when we pit all or nothing, you know, sort of divide up these arguments all one way or all another way, it doesn't really move us forward. But nonetheless, climate is one of these interesting situations right now where we see such strong agreement. You know, 97% of climate scientists from all over the world, you know, scientists whose work is very carefully vetted, very carefully reviewed. There is such strong agreement that, yes, our climate is indeed warming. We're seeing global warming throughout the atmosphere around the entire planet, and that it is caused by human behavior. So, you know, that the good news, there's good news on this consensus, is that it helps us take action. If we can get beyond the argument of, is this happening or is this a hoax, it really allows us to focus on, no, quality science says, yes, indeed, this is happening. And we can take action. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of ideas and inspiration that come out of this consensus. Let me give you a Minnesota example. You know, I turned to renewable energy in the state of Minnesota, which is already happening. There's really great initiatives throughout the state, but such a move in our energy use, production and use, can help us reduce emissions that cause the warming of the Earth's atmosphere. It can help us improve air quality. It can help us contribute to the state's economic growth. You know, and that last one is a really, I think, an important argument that is often left out. You know, climate change is actually a mechanism for economic growth. It's good. Renewables, for example, are good for business. And one only needs to look at the growth of renewables in the state of Minnesota to gain a sense of the economic potential behind a clean, green transition. So, of course, there's other action we can take. And but, again, the good news is much of the preparedness that we make right now, whether we're preparing for changes we're seeing, or we're trying to reduce our carbon emissions, they can help us improve lives right now in the present.
And so, Tom, just to follow up on that briefly, where did this get lumped in? I know you've been studying climate change for a long time here in the Upper Midwest and across the globe. Actually, you've done some research in Sweden and now here in Minnesota too, of course. And so, when did it happen that the idea of renewable energy and even the concept of climate change became something that was associated with the left or liberal thinking? Like, where did that get this label of, oh, renewable is some kind of a liberal way to do business? How did that happen, in your opinion?
Yeah, you know, it's very unfortunate that we've seen this whole debate and discussion become so entrenched in our red-blue politics. It didn't need to go this way. But, you know, I'm not a historian on these matters, but I know enough about this transition that if you look back to George Bush Sr.'s presidency, he campaigned as a Republican for the office of president with climate change action in his platform. I mean, I got to be careful. I'm not sure it was written into the Republican platform at the time, but it's certainly an issue that he talked about on the trail, that he was going to take action. So there we had, and of course he won that election and became our president. Somewhere during his presidency, there was a huge shift. And I'm not going to get into, like I said, that history, but unfortunately, that shift was strengthened considerably over the next couple decades. You know, we really saw red-blue divisions on energy and red-blue divisions on certain science topics like climate. I think that's changing. Now, just the other day, I heard Senator Rick Santorum, or former Senator Rick Santorum, he's also a former presidential candidate. He's a well-known conservative, you know, and he was talking on a panel on, I think it was on CNN, and he was talking about climate change. And one of the things he said was, everyone agrees climate change is happening. And so for a self-identified Republican conservative to say that makes me very happy that maybe we can get rid of this identity politics around the science of climate change, and we can focus on the science and how we're going to take action, whether we're a Democrat or Republican. And you know, one of the action steps I do see is energy transformation. And that right there also needs to transform from a red-blue arena to a more non-political place.
Yeah. All right. Well, so as I mentioned, there's been a series that we've been working on here in the fall of 2018 and now winter 2019, and WTIP interviewed many of the top fisheries biologists in the North Shore area, including the DNR's area fisheries managers here in Grand Marais over in neighboring Finland, and for the Lake Superior area fisheries. And rather than discussing if climate change is a reality, all of the people that I spoke with specifically talked about the realities of the situation and what the agency, the DNR, is doing to cope with a changing climate. For example, many biologists and others addressing this topic focus on planning for change rather than the actual climate itself. From the standpoint of a fisheries biologist, Dean, what is the DNR doing, and in your office in particular in Finland, when it comes to climate change?
Yeah, in Finland, we've kind of taken a two-pronged approach on climate change. We know it's coming. So one attack is we need to understand how is it going to affect us. Are we collecting the data that is needed that we so we can understand how climate change is affecting our fisheries? So are we collecting the correct data, and are we collecting it frequently enough? So that was one area we spent a lot of time of trying to understand where we should be collecting data and what kind of data. The other prong of attack is adaptation. What are techniques, what are decisions we can make today to that will affect the survivability or the resiliency of fisheries in our area? Are we going to be able to maintain certain species, or are we going to have to look at other possible management strategies? Two of the examples that we've kind of focused on is adaptation strategies. Most of our streams in our area are brook trout streams. Brook trout require cold water and with high oxygen. And with the climate change scenarios, a lot of our streams are looking at having overall warming temperatures that are going to impact brook trout possibly to the to the point of they'll no longer be suitable for them to survive. So we're trying to, one, understand what streams have resiliency to climate change, and two, what can we do to enhance or retain that resiliency. One of the things we do know is a riparian area, the area alongside of a stream that contains the vegetation, having long-lived conifers, tall trees that provide shade to the stream and also provide input to the stream when they fall in the stream, and habitat are important to the survivability of trout in streams. Through different years of forestry management and the changing in climate, we're seeing species that are not compatible to this. We have species that are predicted not to be viable in the future. So we're going into these areas and we're planting species that we believe are going to be resilient to climate change or do well in the future climate conditions. And we're adding a diversity to hedge our bets so that in the future, when the climate's changed enough to start to impact, we have species in the riparian area that's still healthy, rather than having potentially areas of the stream without any riparian vegetation or shrub. Another thing we have identified is cold water habitat is very important for trout. Thermal refuges. Sometimes these are just small feeder streams that stay cold throughout the summer. Sometimes they're big pools within, or sometimes in rare cases we have some groundwater input. So these areas are important for the trout to reach. So streams are often a network where the fish move up and down the main stream into these tributaries. However, sometimes they are unable to move up and down the stream system because of barriers. And often in our case, they're culverts. We've done, as engineering over the years, we've done a pretty poor job of placing culverts in our streams. They're often too small, and they end up being fish barriers. And so we needed to understand how much of an impact our culverts in our area impacting fish connectivity movement. And also being able to move is important for them to reach their spawning areas. So we did, we worked with the Lake County SWCD and other entities, and we did a full survey of all of our culverts, and we found about 30% of our culverts are actually fish barriers. So we're working with various agencies to replace these culverts with bigger culverts that are appropriate sized for the current water condition, and we're also using a technique called mesboic that should allow for channel migration so that future water hydrologic conditions will still be fish passable. So those are two techniques we're using to try to keep the streams resilient and cold to and allow fish to maintain in the future. Part of it, of our strategy, is to do a triage or prioritization. So we're also gathering data to try to classify which streams and lakes will be the most resilient to climate change. There's a lot of work done out there by agencies that have already predicted models on several streams. There's a program out there called FishViz that has predictions of the suitability and survivability of trout in the future. We are trying to refine some of that data, because a lot of it's model data, so we're actually putting a lot more temperature loggers out there to understand our streams better and get better frequency of the water condition throughout our watershed.
All right, and so when you start doing things like introducing trees and shrubs and so forth and impacting the land, for lack of a better way to say it, are those native species? Does that have to be factored into it, and do they provide shade? How does that fit into this?
Fortunately, one of the species that is known to predicted to do well in the future climate conditions in this area is white pine, and that is a native species. The unfortunate part is they're very favored by deer, which deer are also predicted to do better, so we need to protect them. We are looking at assisted migration, we call it, species that are native to Minnesota but not necessarily on the North Shore, doing some plantings with them so that we have a diversity of species to kind of hedge our bets so that there are some species that are not here now but will be predicted to be here in the future. But we don't have that 50 to 100 years to allow nature to take its course to move them up here to be in part of the riparian area.
Okay, and it can take, of course, a long time for a tree to get to an adequate size where it can provide any sort of shade. So how long out of the planning does that have to fit before this can be effective?
Yeah, that's exactly why we realized we needed to start acting now, as these conditions are often, you know, predicted to be to the point of impact in about, you know, 2050 and so on. And so in order to have these established mature trees, they have to be planted now. So that's why we're working with various agencies, including the Nature Conservancy, the North Shore Collaborative. We're working with these agencies to get these trees planted and established now, so that in 30 to 50 years we actually have a mature riparian area.
All right. So, Steve, here in the Grand Marais Fisheries Office, what if any similar efforts are being done, or is there some things that Dean didn't mention that you would like to touch on as far as, you know, what the Grand Marais Office for the DNR Fisheries is doing when it comes to climate change?
Well, the things that Dean mentioned are a very common thread in fisheries offices across the state. Everybody's dealing with climate change that's already happened, and climate change that we expect to be upon us in the next 50 to a couple hundred years. So it's a long time frame to work with. And Dean's exactly right. Well, many of these measures, unless you start them now, they don't really come into play in time to have any meaningful effect. So people need to have that long frame point of view. One of the things we've been doing is getting away from the cold water a little bit. We expect to see more waters that will be more suitable to warm water species. So things like bluegill and crappie perhaps may become more important in some of our systems. In some cases, they're already here, and maybe they'll start to do better over time. We're certainly seeing that in some lakes. But in other cases, we have to look more closely, and we are looking more closely at where it might make sense to bring them in to replace a fishery that perhaps we expect to falter a little bit. We're seeing surges in smallmouth bass, it seems. That's one that doesn't really need our help. They seem to be getting along pretty well on their own, and it's not a happy thought for a lot of anglers, but boy, they save a lot of fishing trips for people. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's probably going to become more prominent in people's experience. And then, and I know Dean that does this too, we spend quite a bit of time working with our land management partners on a really broad scale, on a watershed or a landscape scale, to try to work with the amount of forest cover we have out there. One of the things that is happening and will continue to happen with climate change is that we'll see more extreme events, extreme weather events, high rainfalls and that sort of thing. Those can be quite damaging to streams if you have too much of the landscape in sort of an open land, where very young forest or developed lands. So we try to work hard with our partners to encourage that sort of wide look at how much of that activity is going on in the watershed.
Okay, and so when you mentioned partnership, is there any overlap or communication directly between the Finland Fisheries Office and here in Grand Marais? Dean, do you guys, you and Steve, communicate about some of these efforts and just this idea of climate change in general?
At times, we have pretty defined boundaries and we're pretty busy, so the overlap isn't probably as much as we'd like, but we do, like Steve was mentioning, in coordination with forestry, with the different forestry, we have similar mindsets and similar goals that sometimes these cuts or areas will cover both of our areas, and so we'll work together on establishing comments or working with our partners. For just the nature of the beast, we're unfortunately pretty specific to our area, so our opportunities to collaborate aren't probably as great as we'd like them to be.
Mm-hmm. But we do try to, to with our best effort, to kind of keep a consistent and scientifically accurate point of view out there. So we talk back and forth and in our groups within the section of fisheries and with other disciplines to try to make sure that we all have a common understanding of how to approach these issues.
Yeah, and I'm curious to hear about just the word, the phrase itself in the office. Do people, I mean, can you just say, hey, today we're talking about climate change. This project that we're doing is specific to climate change, or is that sort of a, you go around that phrase for whatever reason, be it political or whatever the reason might be?
I think that we no longer really go around it. I think we're pretty direct and straightforward in talking about climate change with all of our partners. People that we work with in the resource side of things really do seem to understand that this is happening, has been happening, and will continue to happen. And it's something that we have to find a way to deal with. People like us who work in the water and we work on fish, there's not much we can do necessarily ourselves to reduce the CO2 emissions, but we certainly can keep that idea in the front of people's minds, try to promote those policies as much as we can, and not be afraid of the thought and the discussion of climate change, because it's a real thing.
Yeah, all right. Well, so this series that we worked on here at WTIP, we talked, of course, it's about fish and fishing, so that's what a lot of our features are specifically about, including the interviews. A video that was produced by Matthew Baxley is about fish and fishing, but I'm curious to step just briefly away from that side of it, because the changes to our fisheries are meaningful for not just anglers, such as myself, of course, but also for others who enjoy all kinds of recreation along the North Shore. So, Tom, I'm curious what your thoughts are about this idea that, you know, we're talking about fisheries and impacts to fish and fishing on the North Shore, but this could also impact just other forms of recreation here on the North Shore. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, first off, if I could just follow up on something that Stephen, I just want to commend Dean and Steve and the Minnesota DNR, because, you know, to see agencies that are looking at goals way out into the future the way they are is so refreshing, and it's so critical when it comes to climate adaptation. You know, we really have to be preparing for 2050, as difficult that is, because we're sort of in the moment, an in-the-moment species, right? So to plan that far out is a challenge. So I just want to commend what where the DNR is at with that. And as long as I'm commending the DNR, let me talk about the State Climatology Office. Kenny Blumenfeld, who is a DNR climatologist. And I'm getting to your recreation question, Joe, I promise.
Yeah, but no worries.
Kenny talks about, he does an excellent job of taking the science, what we know, like what we've observed and what is projected, and he puts it into, in a sense, three bullet points. You know, in northern Minnesota and northeastern Minnesota, we're warmer and wetter over the course of the year. You know, and statistics show us that is the case right now, projected into the future. We're losing our winter cold. I know that's not an easy topic to believe on this weekend, but that's, again, we got to remember the difference between weather and climate. But we are losing our winter cold, and especially our overnight cold. And that's borne out in temperature records across the state of Minnesota. And then, as Steve or Dean, one of them mentioned, you know, we're seeing these severe precipitation events. That's the third major observed climate change, projected climate change. So those are the three I really focus on. And so let me jump to that second one, loss of winter cold, because it relates to our winter recreation in pretty significant ways. You know, we've been talking about fishing and, you know, angling, but let's put it in a winter context. You know, ice fishing is something that's quite unique to Minnesota. It's very important culturally, and there's a certain amount of ice fishing tourism. And so if we have inconsistent ice cover or changes in ice cover, that, you know, are uncertain or unpredictable, that has a huge impact. In fact, the State Climatology Office has been able to document that our part of the state, I believe, has lost about 12 ice days over the past few decades. So we're losing our ice, and that has recreation implications. And not just for anglers. Think about snowmobilers. You know, that the lakes become you know, certainly not in the boundary waters, but outside the boundary waters, our inland lakes are favored snowmobile areas. And so uncertain ice or uncertain and snow conditions have a big impact on snowmobile recreation in our region. Cross-country skiing, you know, again, that uncertainty in the snowpack, we're seeing, it's not that we have less snow, it's that when the snow is coming and the temperature swings that we're experiencing, it's more of a unpredictability of snow. And it's gone so far in Duluth that the local cross-country ski team wanting to make sure that our high school kids and families that want to ski are going to have predictable snow, that they put a lot of money into snowmaking or cross-country skiing at the base of the Spirit Mountain facility. So that right there is a climate adaptation that recreationists are saying, how do we safeguard or secure snow in an uncertain winter climate? And then we can shift to other seasons too. You know, I've heard even Dean mention, you know, our changing Northeast Minnesota forest. And of course that has all the ecological implications, but it also has implications for our tourism. You know, if I think of, like, if the Emerald Ash Borer makes its way through Minnesota and destroys our ash, I think of, like, the black ash swamps of northern Minnesota, and the loss of that species changes our landscape. And so there's connections people have to places, where their cabins are, where they always visit, based on the composition of the forest. And if that's changing, that has an impact. There's a whole emerging field of study looking at the emotional health impacts of a changing climate. So as people lose what's familiar and what's certain or what's culturally valuable or important, like ice fishing with grandpa or going to the hunting shack, you know, if we're losing some of these recreational cultural indicators, it's having a huge impact on people's well-being, mental health and well-being. So I think there's a real strong identity question there of what, you know, who we are as Northeast Minnesotans and how climate change will change that. Now, not to be completely negative, you know, maybe, you know, we'll have longer autumns. You know, like, maybe there will be impacts that some people will find favorable in terms of tourism or recreation. You know, that we don't talk as much about that, but certainly, you know, you get optimists who say that they're going to get out and enjoy northern Minnesota no matter what. So they put their cross-country skis away and they pull out their fat bikes, or they put on their ice cleats and they go hiking. So there's lots of different ways we can approach this, but certainly we see a changing outdoor recreation in our region.
Yeah, okay. And so, Steve, on that note then, let me follow up with that idea of changes aren't always necessarily a bad thing. We don't have to view it always from the this change is going to have a negative impact on my life. And something you mentioned earlier in the program was more crappie, maybe more panfish in the area, more bass. These types of changes don't necessarily have to be viewed as a bad thing. Is that a safe assumption or an accurate way to look at it?
Yeah, there are some positive aspects. Things like panfish are extraordinarily popular in Minnesota. I mean, if you were really to think about what we are, we're kind of a sunfish fishing state, maybe more than we are a walleye steak. Lots of families and kids enjoy that sort of thing. And having a few more opportunities to do that is not necessarily a bad thing. We do worry about what we have to trade to get there. We'd rather not be forced, you know, by unfortunate circumstances to have to do that. But as long as that is the direction we're headed, we can make the best of it where we can. That's what an adaptation is.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll get back to that in just a moment, but I want to remind our listeners tonight that we're doing a program, Climate Change and Its Impact on North Shore Fisheries. That's the topic of this month's third Thursday community conversation here on WTIP. So let's get back into changes then about some things that could potentially happen here, and I want to focus on one specific species here, the iconic species for many anglers here up the Gunflint Trail, throughout the region, the Boundary Waters region. Of course, we're talking about lake trout on inland lakes here, and also, of course, Lake Superior as well. But for our purposes this evening, we'll focus on inland lakes. And is it possible, I'll just put it right out there, that in the next 50 years, you know, in my lifetime here, that there could be no lake trout fishing that could be had on some lakes here in Cook County up the Gunflint Trail? Dean, Steve, anybody want to take a shot at that one?
I would say that in the 50-year span, we will still have lake trout, and we'll probably still have lake trout in a lot of the lakes that have lake trout now. But we're not talking about changes that are going to happen over 50 years and then turn around and kind of come back. A lot of people are saying we're looking at a 200 or 400-year period. And the number of lakes where lake trout can be sustained over that kind of time span with some warming continuing is probably fairly small. I think we do have a few lakes that will be able to sustain their lake trout on our inland waters. Our deepest, largest, coldest lakes should still hold some habitat. But we have already lost some lake trout lakes. And our shallower lakes are at great risk. Lake trout in many of those lakes will not survive over the next 50 to 100 years.
And Steve, just to put it in an even more specific context, do you have a name or two or three of a lake that may not have lake trout that does or did in the past, recent future?
Well, I can name a couple of lakes that we're concerned about now. I mean, I think you can look pretty hard at a lake like Trout Lake. A Trout Lake is a wonderful lake trout lake, but it's only 70-some feet deep and it's not very big. And we're already seeing some summers where by the end of the summer, lake trout are pretty squeezed in the amount of habitat they have. Another one that might be surprising to some people is Greenwood Lake. Quite a large lake, but not a terribly deep lake. And the main basin of Greenwood Lake looks pretty good, but when you get to some of the smaller basins, there's not much habitat there left for lake trout by the end of the summer. And you know, you give that another few decades, and I could see that really struggling. On the other hand, you've got lakes like Clearwater Lake or Gunflint Lake or Loon Lake, long, deep, narrow trenches, lots of cold water down there. They're probably going to be okay for a good long time.
Mm-hmm. But possibly seeing increased pressure if there's only so many options to choose from.
Well, that's exactly right. And the other thing that we would expect to see even on those lakes is that although lake trout will most likely persist, the amount of suitable habitat will be reduced. And so they won't be able to support the kind of harvest that they can support now. So we will have to be pretty careful that we adapt our harvest strategies to what the lakes can support in their new condition.
And being that it's now only a maximum of two per angler, it's not much room for flexibility in something like that.
Well, when you look at something simple like the bag limit of two, yeah, there isn't much farther down you can go, but there are other tools in the toolbox that allow you to maintain some harvest and still preserve, you know, the spawning stock, for instance. And in more cases, we may have to look at that.
Okay. Dean, any lakes in the Finland area, your fisheries area, that stand out, either lake trout, brook trout, any just that may be at a risk specifically from climate change?
Yeah, we don't have as many lake trout lakes as Steve does, but we do have quite a few stream trout lakes, and especially in the Finland area, they don't have the depth. So the habitat, or the, what we call the oxythermal habitat, the amount of our lake stratify and the amount of habitat that's both has the correct amount of oxygen and cold water gets pretty narrow in the summer. And we've actually have lost a few lakes that were probably marginal to begin with, but now are not suitable. And so one lake in particular, Beaver Hut, this year we looked at, and there was no survivability of spalake. And when we measured the oxythermal habitat, it went to zero for a couple weeks. So that was a lake that in the past did provide an opportunity for anglers to go out and fish for spalake. And now it's no longer, this no longer appears to be suitable. And the watershed has not changed much and the fish community. So we attribute a little bit to climate change. We don't have the records on the lake to prove that, but we foresee this potentially happening in several more of our stream trout lakes in the near future.
Okay. Well, so let's get back into precipitation. I think that's a key aspect of some of the changes that we might see. I mean, scientists across the globe are reporting that warming temperatures on this planet are fundamentally altering the water cycle and shifting these precipitation patterns. We've seen it right here in Cook County and Finland area here in recent years, where the rainfall is just increasingly abundant at times and just in desperately short supply at other times. Steve, when it comes to North Shore fisheries, Grand Marais fisheries here, why do we care about rain patterns? What does this mean in this context of what we're talking about here tonight?
Well, if you've been in the area for the past 10 years, you've been through some really severe storm events. And you can look at any of the area streams and see what effects those had. A lot of the stream channels have blown out. They're a lot wider than they were and wider than they should be. And we've got more erosion along the stream banks, big slumps that are contributing sediment. Once you get a big exposed slump, it's exposed. And then it doesn't even take a big rainfall to move a lot of sediment down into the river. So those things really matter. They really change the character of a stream. On the flip side, when we have those periods of drought that slide in, we can lose fisheries. And if we see that happen too regularly, these brook trout streams can not come back. A lot of our brook trout streams only have maybe 3 year classes of brook trout there. And if they get knocked out in one bad drought, there's not much left to bring them back. And I can think of droughts we had and droughts that we had that preceded cold winters in 2002 and 2007. In those years, the flow in the streams was very low. The small streams froze to the bottom and stayed that way. And we lost quite a bit of brook trout water in those years. Some streams kind of slowly staggered back after 2002, only to be knocked down again in 2007, and some of those have not come back yet. So those events, even when they're kind of short-term, if they're extreme, they can do a lot of damage, and it's lasting damage because some of these populations don't have the resiliency to recover. Dean talked about refuges. The thermal refuges are really important because they help that core group of fish get through an event like that, so you've got something to come back from.
Yeah, so when we're talking about the rivers on the North Shore, I mean, from the Knife to the Pigeon, they're all susceptible here to the impacts from climate change, and we're talking about them in the broader context of each of them is at risk. But Dean, you mentioned this a little bit earlier as well, that some are at a greater risk than others, and I'm asking, can you expand on that? Because that's an interesting notion to me, that some, you know, either because of depth or brush or whatever the case may be, what makes some at a greater risk than others?
Yeah, streams on the North Shore are very similar, but they're not identical. In the stream community, often we look at components of a stream, which initially starts with hydrology, which affects hydraulics, which affects the geomorphology of the stream, which affects the physical, chemical aspects of the stream, which ultimately affects the biology of the fish. Some streams have better watersheds, more forested watersheds. Some have maybe perhaps more groundwater, or they're, for whatever reason, they have a better base temperature that's already colder than neighboring streams. Sometimes the geomorphology is different. So these different characteristics often make some streams that have more resilience, or they're at a more functioning level at today's climate, that because they have a good watershed, perhaps the number of cold tributaries entering it, physical characteristics of like that make it more resilient. Other streams or rivers have maybe more open area, or have warmer initial temperatures, and less resiliency. These are predicted to probably be impacted greater or quicker in the climate change scenarios.
So. Yeah, and so where does the baptism, which flows through basically your backyard there at the office, where does that fit into the middle ground of this, or where would that be?
Yeah, a lot of the climate change models look at it as a moderate kind of risk for change. Portions of the baptism have these tributaries that are very cold. The main stem, especially during the midsummer, warms up quite a bit. It does have good portions of the watershed that are in protected state, in a state park or public lands. But the existing temperatures now are warm enough that it does make it critical that it certain portions of the stream will probably be less suitable for trout for longer periods. So that's why this connectivity, the making sure that these fish in the main stem of the baptism can reach these colder tribs, is so important to us, and establishing and maintaining these riparian areas to keep the tributaries and the main stem colder is so important to us.
Yeah, what might be one that is at the greatest risk if you have a scale of what might be a river in your area that's at the greatest risk?
Well, latitude has a lot to do with it. The closer you get to Duluth, the less resilience, the warmer the temperatures are predicted to be. The further north you get towards Canada, just the overall temperature, it's predicted to do better. So in my area, the streams closer to Duluth are predicted to do to become warmer and not suitable for trout would be like the Silver River and parts of the Stewart River.
Okay. Steve, how about here in the Grand Marais area? Any that are seem to be like they might be able to withstand some dramatic changes to the climate? And then also, what are some that are at the greater risk? So some that seem like they might be okay in the long run or you know, foreseeable future, and some that appear to be at a great risk here.
Well, among the larger streams, the Cascade River looks pretty good. The main stem of the Cascade can get fairly warm. Under the wrong conditions, you might say, but it has such a wealth of good cold water tributaries feeding it that there's always that reservoir of trout ready to move back into the system. So a stream like that should be in pretty good shape. The main stem, maybe the fishing would come and go, but overall they ought to be able to persist there. There is a lot of beaver activity in that watershed. There's a lot of gravel mining ramping up there, and those are things that we kind of have to keep an eye on. But that one's in pretty good shape. We're up on the north end of the North Shore, so as Dean said, as you go farther north, things look better and better. But we do have some systems now that are quite marginal. Couple that come to mind are the Swamp River and the Stump River systems up the Arrowhead Trail. At one time, both were known to be brook trout streams, and now you're hard-pressed to find trout in either one of those. So there it's a combination of water temperature, which seems to be elevated now, and flow, which seems to be less reliable. So we have these periods of extremely low flow and really limits the habitat available.
Okay. Well, so Tom, I want to call myself out here. I don't know if this jumped out to you when I said this or not, but I had mentioned earlier when talking specifically about my own interest in lake trout fishing, and will there be lake trout in some of the lakes here up the Gunflint Trail in my lifetime? You know, maybe from, that's just, I use the term fit next 50 years. And then Steve pointed out that, you know, we're not planning necessarily thinking just about your lifetime, Joe. He didn't use those words, but he said, we're not thinking just 50 years. We're thinking hundreds of years. And so that's why I want to call myself out, is that line of thinking part of the issue, perhaps, with climate change, Tom, that the idea that I'm thinking only about my own life and not future generations, that perhaps there needs to be a societal shift here to really grasp or take this concept more seriously.
Yeah. I mean, and now we're getting into sort of the whole environmental psychology of all this, but, I think when the public thinks about, you know, not their own future, but their kids' future, their grandkids' future, then we start to get into a place where it's much easier to recognize the importance of the long-range view. And because all signs are that if we don't take action now, you know, the changes that we're observing today, projections could get much worse. And so there really is a, you know, I don't like to inject panic or fear into these conversations, but I think a sense of urgency right now about our own selfish wants and needs, be it lake trout or cross-country ski trails, but also, you know, what we want for the people that we lead, that will come after us in this place. And it is, it's a critical time point for us to be having these discussions. You know, I'm encouraged, you know, that actually, you know, so we had this presidential report come out in December, and it really, it sounded the alarm, and it was agency after agency of the federal government that were on board with climate change. And I'm not sure if our executive branch or president's on board, but much of our federal government is on board as we think about taking action and having a sense of urgency. So even though we can look at projections and some of them are quite dire, I feel a lot of hope. I feel like the tide is turning and there's a greater mobilization to take action. And the work of the DNR that we've been hearing about tonight is one prime example.
Yeah. All right. Fantastic. And so then on that note, while we're talking about some of the work that's being done by the DNR and just the discussion of climate change impacting North Shore fisheries, Steve, why is it important that we're having this conversation? Why is it important that the DNR is aware of climate change, is addressing it, you know, matter-of-factly and getting involved with the science as opposed to the political side or weighing into that? Why is it important that there are brook trout in these streams or lake trout in the lakes? What's the overall sense of why this is important, even this conversation?
Well, it's fish in the lakes, if I just kind of narrow down on that. Everybody who comes to recreate on a lake that wants to go visit a lake shore, even if they're just going to pop up a chair and enjoy the sunshine on the beach. They have an interest in clean water, a nice clean lake out there, high water quality. But some of the people that have the most active interest in those same things are the anglers. And so if you lose the fish populations that are important to anglers, and that interest wanes a little bit, it's a loss because you lose the interest in that resource, the real motivation, the strong motivation to keep those waters in good condition. And then when you know, it's just I don't really know how to describe it, to walk along a stream that's crystal clear and bubbling over the stones in a stream bed that looks pretty nice and not all blown out and washed away. it's just a better feeling. It just gives you a better feeling inside that you're in an area that's in good shape, that's treated well, and it is kind of food for your soul, you know, to see that sort of thing. And so we don't want that to go away. I don't think anybody does. But many of the people that are out there fishing on the lakes are some of the most strongly motivated people to get out there and make those arguments and call their congresspeople and write letters to the editor. And boy, we really need that.
Yeah, yeah. So Dean, why is it important, some of the stuff you talked about, connectivity, you know, addressing some of the culverts that have been an issue for brook trout to reach parts of the stream that are cooler so that the population can survive? I mean, the work that must go into that, the labor, the planning, the engineering, all of the work that's involved with that is extensive. And why is it important?
I think it all goes back to the first time I read San County Almanac with the land ethic, the connection to people, the importance of people, connection to the resource, as Steve was talking about. Our jobs are, the anglers are our bosses. They're the people that provide us with the funding so that we can maintain these experiences for them. These are experiences that the public wants and desires, not only for them, but for their grandchildren. It's very important for me to have these experiences with my children, and I want these experiences for their children as well. The science is coming out more and more. You see these reports of people spend too much time on their iPhones, and there's actually a physical positive response for going hiking, from going fishing, from going kayaking. If we lose these, opportunities, we lose a part of our souls, a part of our culture.
Yeah, and so I've spent, you know, the past several months now, and along with Matthew Baxley here, reporting on this very topic, climate change impacts on North Shore fisheries. And I'm curious, you know, now we've just done an hour-long live radio program, but Steve, are people aware of the DNR's efforts here in Grand Marais about climate change and fisheries? Just, you know, common anglers that we might run into at Bucks as we're picking up a lure or some bait. Are people aware of these efforts on a broader sense without before this series started, perhaps?
Well, I don't know that I'd say there's a lot of awareness of efforts. Well, we're not always that good at beating our own drum or getting that kind of word out there. I think there's more awareness now of the issues and of climate change. And when we talk to people about what's happening in a lake and we try to explain, well, this is something that's, you know, you can expect to see occurring, heads nod now rather than being shaken at us. So I think that's an improvement. You know, I'd like people to be more aware of what all the different agencies are doing to try to address this. I'd like them to support that as much as they can, if that's comfortable with them. But I'm glad to have the chance to be able to do that in any case. And we'll concentrate a little bit more just on getting the word out there that the effort is needed and important. And we need to see it through for the long, long run.
Yeah, all right. Well, and then, Dean, from your point of view, I don't know if you, it seems like just on getting to know you a little bit through this series that you're not in this for the fanfare of the whole thing, that you take your job as the fisheries biologist manager very seriously in the hard work that you do. But do you ever hear from people as you're out in the field that thank you for what you've done or any of that? Are people even aware of any of these efforts?
At times, as a public servant, sometimes we hear the negatives a lot better. Darn near Russian is a term I hear a lot. But working with the groups, the people that are dedicated to the resource, the Trout Unlimited people, the Arrowhead Fly Fishers that see the impacts of the trout streams, that have a passion, are very, very appreciative of our efforts. Overall, if you look at the science studies out there on perception of the public, most of the public does think the DNR is doing a good job. We just sometimes tend to hear from critics. What, as Steve's mentioned, I think recently what I've noticed, there's a lot more understanding of potential impacts of climate change and people observing changes in fish communities and fish fish reproduction and things like that. There are people, anglers, that are observing them and coming to us and saying, what's going on here? We've noticed a shift in this community. It's a little frustrating that we can't do more, but I think we're moving in the right direction. So,
all right. And then just lastly, Tom, we've got about 2 minutes left, and I'd like to end this discussion on something that you have brought up and really seemed passionate about, is that idea of hope, that we're not having a gloom and doom conversation here, that in the future we will be able to go up the Gunflint Trail and catch lake trout, and not just me, but future generations as well. And why is that important, Tom, to keep in mind that this, there is still room for hope in this conversation here?
Yeah, I think it's critical. I think our hope fuels our action. And so, you know, changes are afoot and changes are coming, you know, and that's, I guess, the way of the world. There's, you know, all kinds of natural changes that we adjust to and experience. Right now we're entering a phase where some of these changes might be coming a little more rapidly. But when we think about climate change, these observed and projected changes, if we get past, I mean, if we can really embrace this consensus on the science, that opens the door to action. You know, whether it's the kind of adaptation that we've been hearing about tonight, you know, how we're preparing for the long, you know, the long haul on North Shore streams and preparing for a changing climate, or if it's the mitigation side, what we can do right now, you know, to reduce our impact. You know, I might be sitting at the airport tonight, but it's because I took the light rail from downtown Minneapolis. Now I'm going to catch a shuttle to head down to Rochester. You know, it's like transportation. We can think creatively about transportation. We can think creatively about energy. We can think creatively about what we do with our garbage in our homes. You know, there's all kinds of hopeful action that can be taken to reduce these emissions that will, you know, in the long run, make sure that we don't hit those worst-case projections. So I say hope leads to action.
All right. Fantastic. Well, that will have to do it for tonight. And you've been listening to this month's Third Thursday Community Conversation. We've been discussing climate change impacts on North Shore fisheries. My guests tonight were Finland Area Fisheries Supervisor with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Dean Perrone, Grand Marais Area Fisheries Supervisor for the DNR, Steve Persons, and joining us on the phone from Minnesota, Sea Grant, actually down at the airport in Minneapolis, about to catch a shuttle to Rochester, Tom Beery. Thank you to all of you for being on this program tonight, and thank you, listener, for tuning in as well.
Deep green, the dark green, gray poles, the mist shrouds, dark lakes, the snow caps, gravel beds and the rivers raise the mountains bare than the scarred land, but the regrowth's coming back again, come back again, you bet I will be back again to the regrowth, back again to the mist shrouds, back again to the dark lakes, come back again to the rivers race, green on white over green on blue, green on black over green on gray, green on white over green on blue, darker gray over green on gray, over green on green, over green on green, over green on green, over green on green. The deep green, the dark lakes, when the giants found our old teeth, raven croaks when the cabbage flower grows amongst the deep green, from the logging camps to lumber camps, deep green, the mist shroud, cedar air, the fishing town, salmon streams run golden brown, and rain it falls, rainbow arcs, white wisp over deep dark, white wisp over deep dark. You coming back again? Come back again, you bet I will be back again to the big road, back again to the mist shrouds, come back again to the dark lakes, come back again to the river's race, green on white, green on blue, green on black for darker gray, green on white, green on blue, green on gray, green on green, green on green. To the green on green, to the green on green, to the green on green.